This is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
If you've never seen the movie Ray, you should see it. It's pretty good. That dude, who's it? Jamie Foxx? He does a pretty good job in that. Joining me now, Jeff Kenney, Colonel, United States Marine Corps, retired. Jeff, what's up?
Good morning. How you doing, Mac?
Yeah, I'm good. You ever seen the movie Ray?
No, I have. I missed that one.
Yeah, it's good. It's good.
Yeah.
How about you, Tim Lynch, Major type, United States Marine Corps, retired. Tim, good morning.
Good morning, Matt.
Whoa, listen to that. We're not dealing with all that shit phone service you got down there in McAllen, Texas.
No, 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 and I'm pumping you through my hearing aid so I can hear, too. This is awesome.
Yes! What? Have you seen the movie, Ray?
I have not.
Good God, man. What do you guys do with your lives? Okay, anyway, we won't get into that. It's actually a good movie. He was not blind at birth. He was blinded. I can't remember what disease he got. I don't know how it happened, but yeah, grew up rural, dirt poor in the South, and then was blinded, and then lived the rest of his life like that. So anyway, but he does a great job in the movie. So just thought I'd throw that out to you. So on a cold night in Texas or a cold night, which are a lot of in Southern California now, you can go ahead and check that movie out. Now let's talk about the cold temperatures in Southern California. Jeff, do you attribute this to global warming, El Nino? Do you think it's a threat to the world? What do you think?
Well, I'm torn. I mean, it's supposed to be warm when you have global warming. Although it's been explained to me that really every anomaly in weather is really because the globe is warming. And if I don't believe that, I'm a racist. So I just keep my mouth shut usually. And although I don't understand that connection, it must be something that's being taught in a new way in our university system, where if you don't believe that cold weather is really hot weather, you're a racist. I mean, I know that I'm just not smart enough to grasp that. I got the idea about how to do deflection and elevation on an aiming circle for mortars and so forth, but I've not developed the nuanced personality to grasp the concept.
Well, if you want to see eyes roll, right, in people that aren't very smart, start teaching deflection and elevation. So what we're really talking about is applied geometry.
Right.
I hated geometry. First of all, I didn't want to learn all those rules because, like, what's the point? Right. And now we're going to, like, apply them and move shit around. Come on, man. I want no part of that.
I know. But when you're talking about we're going to put a bomb on top of somebody by using deflection elevation charge, it takes on a whole new meaning.
Yeah. And then, but see, what comes out of that is the smart guy. Because he runs the FDC, because there's somebody in the mix that says, oh, I got that.
Right.
And they get the right answer, and everybody looks at him like, what? And then his name becomes Genius. Hey, Genius. Musselman. That's how he got his start in the Marine Corps.
Yeah. Really?
Yeah. That and going on a working party when he was a recruit. Yeah. And he was at the end of the line, and they're like, you, chow hall, chow hall, chow. Hey, you're going to go to the armory. Huh? Yeah, you stupid mouth breather. You're going to the armory. And that's how Musselman got his at least his little bit of an introduction about two things. One, always be last in line for the working party. And two, going to the armory is not a bad thing. How about you, Timmy?
Yeah, I think that if you have a theory that cannot be disproved, then you don't have any kind of phenomenon that's credible. So if it's this polar vortex is from global warming, then what are we talking about as far as global warming? If the hurricane season delivers no hurricane, that's global warming. If hurricanes hit, that's global warming. I don't think we had a tornado this year. That's global warming. But last year when there were tornadoes, that was global warming too. So the theory is ridiculous.
You're spoken like a true racist.
It sounds all encompassing. And again, the hard one is, how do you link the lack of belief in a weather theory to racism, Jeff?
Because it's the worst thing they could say to somebody in their life. Like, you know, you call somebody a racist. It used to be a horrific thing to be called, although now it's so much. It's almost like, yeah, you know, there's a quote in Shakespeare. I don't remember which play, but
what?
Somebody's castigating.
Whoa, this is the first time. Hey, just for the record, this is the first fucking time this has ever happened on this program. Somebody's quoting Shakespeare? Are you shitting me? Other than, like, the obligatory.
You got to fight back against the global warming thing some way.
So
why not old Will?
So you memorize.
If you're racist all the time, you say, if I am a dog, beware my fangs.
Ooh.
Which means, if I'm such an asshole, why are you hanging out? Well, it could mean. That's the other good thing about Shakespeare. It could mean, it's a lot like global warming theory. It can mean anything you want.
The Bible. You know,
in the Bible, right?
You know, it says in the Bible. Yeah, I know that. But you know what? It also says in the Bible that the sun shines on a dog's ass every once in a while.
Right.
It does? Where does it say that? Corinthians 3:67.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Have you seen the guy at the football game that says with the 367 sign on it? No. That's right.
That's what that means.
That's
huh?
right. That's because it's a CIA thing.
What? Of course it is.
All right, Timmy, any final thoughts on how we link global warming to racism?
No. I guess I'm a racist, and I just got to just keep my head low like Jeff. Never knew it.
We both are.
I never thought I was. Yeah.
How funny. Look, my racist moment of the week this week, I don't normally have one. But I will this week is Kamala Harris after the dude in Chicago fakes the attack, right?
Right.
She comes out and says, this is a modern day lynching. And so now that it doesn't appear to be a modern day lynching, it appears to be a modern day fabricated bunch of bullshit. When she's asked about it, she says, you know, this is an ongoing investigation. And it would be inappropriate for me to comment until all the facts are in.
Although I saw something on the internet. You know that guy who strangled a mountain lion to death in Colorado that jumped on him?
Oh, my God.
I saw on the internet, he said that the mountain lion, before it jumped on him, said, this is MAGA country. So, I didn't make that up, although I wish I did. I read it. My wife showed it to me on the internet. So.
Yeah, let me tell you. And then let's see. What else is going on? That kid from that Catholic high school in
Ohio.
Kentucky.
Oh, Kentucky?
Yeah, right. Kentucky. He's suing the Washington Post for $250 million.
Yeah.
I
love it.
I so hope he wins, right? I mean, look, they're on a field trip, and they're being deliberately ambushed in order to create a viral event, and it all goes according to plan, except it's not true.
Right.
But
none of this stuff is true. It's all baloney.
But the interesting part about it is that it doesn't matter if it's true anymore. It just matters that it gets out there, and it did. So,
because they never retract, they never punish people who do. You know, I mean, I'm interested to see what they do with this strangely named Juicy Smullen. If he gets prosecuted for, you know, wasting resources of the Chicago Police Department. I mean, basically, Chicago is like a cold version of 2007 Solder City. I mean, they got 3,000 dead a year.
Yeah, it's crazy.
Getting killed, you know, and to waste time on that. And that polar vortex thing, I mean, he could have picked a better time to fake a thing. Basically, it's so cold.
Nobody's on the street.
Your heart stops. Yeah, unbelievable.
Yeah. Kamala Harris.
That polar vortex thing's intriguing. If you could put that on somebody, like, you know, put it on, like, a country that's pissing you off, you know what I mean? Like, there's trouble down there pick a place that's hot. Okay,
Venezuela.
You know,
Venezuela.
Nigeria, where Boko Haram is. You put polar vortex on them, like, holy shit, this is terrible. the racists are at it again. I'm cold. You know? If you could launch that at somebody, they go, whoa, what are you talking about?
See,
I'm a dog, but where am I?
That's
going?
What we should pay people big money for, right?
Right.
How do we bend this, and how do we shape this in order to blame it on somebody, and then we'll get all the Mickey Mouse people, goddamn Boca Haram, let's kill them all, nuke them.
You're right, man. You get Gunnar Musselman out of retirement, have him figure out the flexion elevation charge to shoot the polar vortex rounds at the enemy, and there you go. We're good.
Yeah. You know, mortars are interesting, especially mortars for Marines, right? Because most of the Marines don't actually understand how they work. And if you ask them, they're like, yeah, we don't know, but he knows. Like, what? Yeah, what?
Well, you know, I was, when I met you guys, remember, I was the weapons platoon commander for EI Company.
Yeah.
The enlisted instructor company for the basic school, supporting the infantry officer course. And I'm watching these mortar guys, and I had a little crew of them, like four or five of these NCOs, who they loved it. They would get together in each other's houses and drink themselves senseless and do whiz wheel stuff, or, you know, the plotting board stuff. One of them doing parallel point, another one doing, parallel line, and they're having competition. I'm thinking, that's got to be a good thing, you know, because none of these guys had more than a high school education.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're into it. They saw the whole world as, you know, as a series of mathematical equations that you put through a hot tube.
Yeah, and they, you know, and the fun part would be, you'd ask the rest of the Marines, and you would say, so what happens if something happens to him? And they say, well, we can't shoot. If we can't direct lay on it, we can't shoot. What? Is that it? Okay, well, that means your asses have to go forward, right? Yeah, we know that, sir, but we can't. The plotting board is too complicated for the rest of us. Okay. All right. That's an employment consideration. Thank you. So, anyway. Go ahead.
Do you guys remember when the Secret Service came to the EI company and asked them how easy it would be to get mortars on target on a White House?
Right.
Does that sound familiar? I thought Jeff was there then.
I think.
Yeah. How?
Man, that's so easy.
How easy it would be to do what?
To basically fire for effect with a mortar section on the White House or some other important building in D.C. And here's the reason that looked like it was possible. Because if you remember, the IRA would take a dump truck with sand and put mortars in the back of it, and they would shoot it. They'd shoot like five or six rounds towards the British, base or, some other or Protestant area. And then the thing would be gone. Truck pull away, tubes taken out, sand turned over. You know, they were pretty good at that type of thing. And so there was wonder. Could this happen with the White House? You know, could something like that be possible?
And they went to the gifted ones at EI Company and at the basic school and asked?
Yeah, it wasn't me, though. It was the guy after me, and I'm trying to remember his name.
Gary Brown.
No, it was his name was – oh, shit, I can't remember now. He came from 1-9, I remember was his
name. Ah, he's a Walking Dead guy. They're famous.
Yeah.
You know what's interesting about The Walking Dead? The Vietnam guys hate that nickname. Right?
Sure.
Oh, they're like, why do they still have that? They get pissed. And then, but young guys are like, oh, it's so cool. I'm part of The Walking Dead. Like, that's not a cool nickname. Do you know the history of it? What?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's basically from Operation Buffalo in 1967, the horrific casualties. And then they left him up in that area, you know, circa Khe Sanh and stuff. And Tim, I remember the first time I ever heard the word trace, Tim was talking about his dad talking to him about 326 was up there too. And in order, the idea was to have a open ground, open like tract of land that had sensors and guard towers and stuff like that, that would stretch across the northern border between South and North Vietnam. And so it would make infiltration problematic for the NVA. And that basically is what triggered the whole focus on the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which went through Laos and Cambodia to the east, to the west. So, but those battles that were fought in the propagation of that trace, one of the first ones was Operation Buffalo, and 1-9 took horrific casualties, even above and beyond what was normal. And then later on, you had 2-4 taking Shiloh casualties, and then 3-26, and then until finally the whole thing kind of solidified with the Battle of Khe Sanh. But Dean, even after Khe Sanh, 1-9 was in several horrific fights, culminating in 1969 with Operation Dewey Canyon, where again, even though it was a great thing, they walked into Laos basically, and they scored huge hits on the NVA, but they were in Laos doing that, and because of the successive high casualties of these operations up there in the DMZ, 1-9 got and held that nickname to this day.
And they don't like it. They don't like it. Jeff Kinney, the historian for 1st Battalion, 9th Marines. Let me tell you a 1-9. Well, go ahead to me, and I want to tell you a funny 1-9 story. Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, because I'm a 1-9 Marine. For a brief period of time when General Mize was a battalion CO, he changed it to Walking Death, had our custom PT T-shirts. All that was Walking Death, and as soon as he turned over the battalion, it went right back. The current Marines hated that. They liked the Walking Dead.
Yeah, right. I thought
this show on TV was about 1-9 when you started seeing it advertised.
This
was about a bunch of zombies.
Yeah, I know. It's like
zombies is the 1-9 and everybody else in the garage on Friday night. But
yeah,
it wasn't tight.
Here's a funny 1-9 story. So, in I want to say 60, might have been 67. Barney Barnum, who's already become
Harvey Barnum, yeah.
No, his nickname's Barney though.
Okay,
that's what his friends call him. So that's what I call him. I'm his friend. I'm his friend. Those who don't know him call him Harvey. That's how he knows you don't know him. So anyway, Barney Barnum. His Medal of Honor story is that he's a first lieutenant in Hawaii at the barracks. They go and they say, hey, our Marines are going to be going to Vietnam. It'd be good if some of us went over there, checked it out. We can come back and start training, blah, blah. It'll be good for the Marines. Okay, well, we're going to rotate an officer, a couple staff NCOs, blah, blah, blah. And Barnum said, well, I'm not married, so I probably should go first. So he gets sent to Vietnam. He's going out, I want to say, with India 3-4, and they're doing some kind of battalion movement to contact or a company movement to contact. As part of a battalion operation. And as they're moving, he's now the RDFO for the company, right? Because he's an RD guy. And so, boom, the first rounds killed the company commander, and the radio operator is down hard. He puts the radio on. He takes command of the company. He FOs and he fights the company for I don't know how many days. And he's TAD. Well, he's TAD. And he gets back, and they tell him, you're going to be put in for the Medal of Honor. So I want to say that's 66. So he goes back to Hawaii, and he's working for General Walt. So he meets General Walt, General Davis, all these guys in the pantheon of heroes of, like, World War II, Korea, and now Vietnam, and now they're above Vietnam, right? These guys are, like, in the Valhalla of the Marine Corps. And so he gets to know them because they hang out together, drink and tell stories and shit. So Walt says, hey, Barnum, if you last as my aide for a year, I'll get you anywhere you want. So he says, all right, sir. So he lasts a year. And at the end of the year, General Walt says, where do you want to go? He says, I want to go to Vietnam. He said, you can't go to Vietnam. You're a Medal of Honor guy. He's like, what do you mean? Davis, he went back. He's like, shut up, Barnum. Nobody's talking to you. And so ultimately he sends him back. So now Barnum goes back as a battery commander. And so he's up on his firebase, whatever. And he's got a company, Alpha 1-9, providing security. And it rotates in to provide security for the firebase. And now they hear these explosions down there. And they're like, Barnum's like, what is that? His battery Gunny. It's like, I don't know, sir, it's Alpha 1-9. I don't know what the fuck they're doing down there. They're new. All right, get their CEO's ass up here right away. Okay, the guy in charge of Alpha 1-9 is First Lieutenant Wesley Fox. Okay, right. So Fox,
1969.
So Fox, along with a whole bunch of other guys, got selected as from being enlisted, and they were made like Today, you're a gunny. You're a mass sergeant or mass. You're a first sergeant selectee. Now you're a second lieutenant. Boom. Go to Vietnam. So now he sends his battery gunny. Go get that lieutenant. So he tells the story. I'm in my tent, and all of a sudden I hear this kind of slap on the outside, which is akin to your three knocks. Come in, sir, First Lieutenant Fox reporting as ordered. And so Barnum says, I turn and I look. He goes, and here's like fucking John Wayne, like the human version of John Wayne standing there.
Right.
Right? He said, to say the least, it wasn't what I expected. And so he says, who the fuck are you? Like, sir, I'm Alpha Company 19. Hey, what are you doing down there, Fox? He's like, well, sir, we don't get any fresh water. So we gotta either hump up to the mountain or we gotta fill canteens when my guys go down to bathe in the river down there. So when we go down to bathe in the river, we drop a hand grenade upstream and then we into the river and then we kill some fish and we have that, so we have at least some fresh food, you know, some food to eat for the Marines.
Right.
Then Barnum says, I just stared at him. Oh. All right. never mind. And Barnum fires for Fox during Fox's action that leads to his Medal of Honor. And he talks about that in that interview. It was the interview that I did with him after Colonel Fox passed away. And he talked about, he said, you should have heard him throughout all of that. He said the coolest guy in the room was Wes Fox. And then he tells these funny stories about, as Medal of Honor recipients, they would march in funerals at Arlington, right? And he said, Fox always was into my ass about being an arty guy. Like, how does an arty guy rate a Medal of Honor? Yeah, the only way is by hanging out with grunts. And so he says, so we're getting ready, and it's getting ready to rain. And I brought an umbrella. And so we kind of march behind the caisson, right?
An umbrella?
Yeah. Right. So he says, so now it just starts pouring, East Coast shit rain pouring at Arlington. And I get my umbrella out. And he said, and Fox is behind me. He said, he's cussing at me as we're walking through Arlington. Barnum, take that umbrella down. I swear to God, I'm going to wrap it around your throat.
That's so much bad luck, man, for a Marine to be open an umbrella. It's like,
in
it's
Arlington.
Worse than global warming, man.
Exactly. It's worse than global warming connected racism.
Worse than a polar vortex.
Exactly. So anyway, that's a kind of humorous 1-9 story, but I always laugh when I think of, like, all of a sudden, like, you're going to chew some lieutenant's ass out for whatever's going on down there, and in walks John Wayne. Disguised as Wesley Fox.
Remember Colonel Lovingood was one of the guys who got commissioned like that.
Yeah, there was a – who was the other guy I've had on the program? He finally got a letter from the Marine Corps because he never went and got a college degree. And Jim Bathurst, I don't know, do you know
him? Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Bathurst. He's like a – I don't know if he was a colonel, but he might have been. And they sent him a letter saying, if you are the only – officer of the Marine Corps above the rank of captain that does not have a college degree, do you think you could invest in one? And they sent him, and he got one. But Bathurst was one of those guys who he could just lead.
He was a CO of 1-8 when I first came to 3-8 in 1988, and they just got back from float. And then he got promoted, and he became the CO SOI East.
Yeah, and that was the end of his career. Yeah. He got into a disagreement, or he butted heads with General Livingston, I think.
Oh,
yeah. And he said, "Yeah, I'm done. I don't need to do this." But Jim Bathurst. You talk about interesting guys.
Right.
Yeah, he an interesting guy, and he's just one of those guys that could do it. He was a platoon commander as a sergeant, then promoted battlefield. I think battlefield promoted to staff sergeant. And interesting guy. Let's talk about. Do you know Jim Bathurst, Tim?
I do not. I don't, but I did listen to your interview.
Well, there you go. Then you might as well. You could say you know him if you listen to the interview. Yeah, by the transitive property of mathematics, I know him. All right, let's talk about Iwo Jima. I've always been a huge fan, and then I went to General Zinni's PME at the basic school in June of or July or whenever the hell it was, the summer of 1990, if I'm not mistaken. And he said, look, let me give all you people out there some advice. Pick a battle and learn everything you can learn about it, right? Read the logistics, read the medical, read administration, read communications. You'll learn more doing that than knowing a little bit about a million battles. So right. I kind of took that to heart, and I've always been fascinated with that battle, and so much is written on it. Very, very cool. And I'll tell you what, if you want an interesting intellectual experience, go look at the Marine Corps Gazette's digital archives of the stuff that gets written right after the battle by people that use pronouns like I and we.
Mm-hmm.
And yep. Not like 50 years later writing shit about it. So pretty, pretty interesting stuff. So what do you guys, when you think of that battle, Tim, what do you think about Iwo Jima?
Well, I was at Iwo Jima for the 50th anniversary. We provided the static display, so I've been on the island.
I fucking hate God.
And there's not a vertical surface that isn't pockmarked. And I've walked up those beaches, and I cannot imagine being in that situation, because it to me is one of the most pure raw courage of coming across in the face of those kind of that kind of firepower. To me, it is flat out amazing. It's stunning to walk along that, and it's hard to come up with the proper description of what it must have took to go across those beaches and keep on fighting. I consider myself a pretty stout, brave guy, but putting myself in that situation, I just cannot. I don't know how the hell they did it. It's terrifying to be on those beaches and imagine what you were facing, and it makes you damn proud that we were able to overcome that thing and keep on going. It's truly a testament to the Corps.
Yeah. You know, I read the book came out in the 70s. That's the history, the Marine Corps story by J. Robert Moskin, that big blue book.
Right.
And I remember reading the part about Iwo Jima, and I was a sergeant on embassy duty in Germany. And he says, in a brutal, deadly way, the Battle of Iwo Jima is what the Marine Corps is all about. And there's not any civilians on it. There's nothing but a determined enemy. Every inch of ground has already been pre-registered by some kind of direct or indirect fire weapon or both. And yet, even though they're attrited below the point where we would say a unit is no longer effective, they still go forward. So it's it really is the beginning of the Marine Corps as it is today. The reputation. Now there's a lot of other battles that were desperate like that before, and then Okinawa after, but Iwo Jima was exclusively Marine, and it was the worst casualty rate of a Corps-sized battle anywhere in World War II that the Americans fought in, for sure.
What I want to talk about some of the unique pieces of the battle, because as you said, I mean, it was an anomaly. There wasn't a whole lot of people on most of those islands, but there were nobody on Iwo Jima. And I mean, it was essentially a cage match. And there's some interesting innovations there. First use of whole blood, right? Mm-hmm. First time that casualties are flown off the island during the fighting. And so that happens. And is there any part of the battle that when you think of it, you think, holy shit, man? Jeff and I were kind of texting yesterday, the number of Medal of Honors that come out of the Marine Corps, what, like a third of them come from Iwo Jima?
Yeah.
And, I interviewed a guy, named Cal Humphrey. It's one of my favorite interviews. I have two really cool interviews I've done. I've done a lot of cool ones, but two that stand out. One was a guy that I interviewed, I want to say in 2001, on the anniversary of D-Day, and he was with the 2nd Ranger Battalion that went up the cliffs at Point du Hoc.
Right.
And I didn't know because I was looking for somebody that was just at Normandy that day, right? I was doing my radio show up in North Dakota. And you would find those people in your community. Like, yeah, my uncle, he was at Pearl Harbor. What was he doing there? He was a gunner. He was part of a gun crew of a 16-inch gun and on the USS Pennsylvania. What? And bring him on and interview him, right? And they're like these local guys who just came back home and they went to work and now they're just local guys. And the interviews are awesome. A nurse from Botno, North Dakota, which is like in the middle of North Dakota, as far north as you could go, right on the Canadian border. She joins the Navy because it's the only way she knows her parents will let her leave, and she knows she'll be safe. She winds up on the USS Solis, anchored in Pearl Harbor, getting ready for formation on Sunday morning. When they hear these explosions, they look out the porthole on the ship, and wow, down the port side, Japanese pilot staring at them as they drive by.
Like, holy cow.
Yeah, and so you get these kind of interviews. Anyway, the guy's name is Harris Holman, and he talks about going up the cliffs at Point du Hoc. And unbelievable story what those guys did. And then the other one is a guy named Cal Humphrey, who's a PFC on Iwo Jima. And he talks about training and meeting John Bazalone at the slop shoot in Hawaii, drinking beer for 5 cents a beer. And so you say, like, you hear slop shoot, right? You read it, nobody uses the term. And all of a sudden he says, yeah, I met John in the slop shoot at Camp Tarawa. What was he like? He's a good guy. He's a big guy, you know, and he had just come back from that big, you know, Bond tour and all that. And, you know, he's a big guy. Everybody knew who Manila John was. And you know, you're hearing this, you're like, holy shit, man. Holy shit. And so, but the story, you know, the stories he tells about, really interesting about, I said, give me something you learned on Iwo Jima. And he says, never be the first one out of a fighting hole. And I said, well, then who goes? He said, I don't know, but not me. And I said, who taught you that? He said, my squad leader taught me that. He said, look, you know, they pump all that bullshit, India. You know, you're 10 feet tall, right? And we're Marines, and we can beat anybody. And it ain't that way. It ain't that way. And he said, and you have to learn that because you see a lot of people get killed. And he said, I think that's why he calls him John. I think that's why John got killed on Iwo Jima. He believed, you know. He said he believed, and he said, from what I heard from my friends, you know, he got up and he did something, you know, pretty crazy, and he said he got killed. And so,
yeah, but Max, 6,800 guys got killed.
Yeah, no, I know. I'm just saying, don't be critical of the PFC, bro.
Right. I am critical. I know.
It's your Italian in you, right? Don't desecrate the memory of John Basil. No, I'm not. I'm just saying that when you hear it from those guys,
right.
It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. So what strikes you about the battle? Have you ever been to the island, Jeff?
No.
You're like, we have to go.
One of my kids did.
Shit.
He got me sand, you know?
Yeah. I don't, like, look, I've seen the sand. I don't want to see any more sand. And I don't want to talk to anybody else who's ever been either. And if one of my kids go before I go, that's going to be a problem that I don't know how well I'll deal with.
I don't know why we just didn't keep that island.
I agree. Why?
You know, when we did that 50th anniversary, we were ordered, don't take any sand, right? And I had all these Marines lined up, and I'm giving them each 1 gallon things. They said, sure, we're not supposed to take any sand. I said, look, any Marine that comes off Iwo Jima doesn't have a bag of sand. Ain't much of a Marine, is it?
Yeah.
That was a ridiculous order. Yeah.
Yeah. That sounds like something. I'm trying to think who would say that.
Men?
Hey, can I tell you guys a quick story about getting stuff like sand and rocks?
No.
Sure.
Of course.
Okay.
So. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, you remember Captain Innerst when we went to IOC? Innerst?
No.
Well, he was one of the instructors at IOC. And he became the 3 for 3/8 when I went my second MU as a lieutenant. And we went to Liberia and kind of split off from the rest of the Mew. And he said to me, he talked like this. He had one of those voices like that. He goes, Jeff. And if he's listening, I apologize for this, okay? But he said, Jeff, I want you to, I get my kids rocks from all the places I've been. And he goes, can you get me some rocks from Liberia? Be careful. You're going to Mamba Point. There's mambas all over there, I tell you. They'll bite you and you'll be dead. But get me a rock or two from, can you do it? And so I looked at him. I said, yes, sir. I was the XO of the of Lima 3-8. So we're in Liberia. We get out of there, and we get out of there in January, right before the bombing started in Kuwait, you know, for Desert Storm, and we floated around. We didn't see any combat. And I see him finally. The Mew gets back together in February, late February, early March of 91 in Rota, Spain. And he goes, Jeff, how you doing, buddy? Hey, did you get me my rocks from Liberia? And I looked at him. I said, yes, sir, they're back on the Newport. I got to get them. And I didn't get them. So I went and around the shipyard there in Rota, I got a couple rocks, and I told him that they were from Liberia, and he was so grateful, you know. And here I am now on this podcast saying it, and I fucked that guy, and I'm sorry, you know. And I went back to Liberia, you know, as a captain, and this time we're in a gunfight, and I still didn't get him any rocks from there.
You had a second crack at it?
Yeah. I was in Liberia twice.
What a total piece of shit.
I know, man. I'm sorry.
Let me tell you, no honor. You had a chance to redeem that out-and-out lie that you perfetrated while you were what's the guy's name, Dr. Brutthead? While you were waiting for that guy, what's his name?
Oh, you mean in Liberia waiting for, or what are you talking about?
Yes, now? That guy. What's his name?
General Buck Naked. My nemesis.
Nemesis.
I was like Stonewall Jackson, and he was like, Hooker.
Your son was Buck Naked. That
I
is awesome.
General Buck Naked.
And you were waiting for him to come down the road. You could have reached out and was like, yeah, I should probably pick up some rocks and put them in my cargo pocket.
Yeah, and I was judicious, though, about choosing those rocks. Around. This looks kind of like an African rock here in Spain. You know?
Well, I mean, honestly, you could make a case because as the tectonic plate shifted, at one time it was one continent. So.
Yeah. But, and now, thanks to global warming,
yes,
those rocks
exactly.
may have migrated.
You're yeah,
right.
Exactly. And were it not for global warming, the Iberian Peninsula would be as close as you could get to Africa. So, by the transitive property of history, there you go.
Yep.
So you right. weren't. Hey, so you. Bottom line is, you weren't a liar. There you go. See, all it takes is a little bit of genius,
yeah.
Right? Here's an email. New lexicon. Mac, when I was in Okinawa in the early 80s, they used to have a daily spot on Armed Forces Radio called The Phrase of the Day. They would teach us helpful Japanese phrases like congratulations on your husband's promotion to Major General. Just the type of helpful phrase that young Marines needed on Gate 2 straight.
They'll get you laid, that general thing.
Yeah. Konnichiwa! What does that mean? Like, I don't know. I learned that in Back to the Future. Marty McFly yelled it.
I already got those assignments. Thank you very much.
Yeah. My son, the Patrick, who just EAS'd out of the Marine Corps, who's making his way, as we do this, back to the East Coast to begin to cohabit with the woman of his dreams and begin a new chapter in his life. Anyway, that little moron at about the age of 7, so he's like a prime Back to the Future, you know, all those movies. He's running through the backyard and he yells, "I know Spanish, konnichiwa!" And I'm like,
it does. That means konnichiwa in Spanish,
yes,
right?
I'm like, but you know how you watch your kid and you're like, that kid's an idiot. Kid's an idiot. What will he ever amount to? That's right. An infantry officer in the Marine Corps. Boom.
Seems to make sense.
Seems that it all makes sense. As soon as you wipe away global warming and therefore racism, because they're too connected, then it all falls into place. The plotting board, all of that. All right. Back to Iwo Jima. Let me tell you what I think is interesting about Iwo Jima. First of all, the Marine Corps goes ashore, and The 4th and 5th divisions are going to go ashore. 3rd division is going to sit off the coast. And then they'll take care of that shit because of the robust bombardment that the Air Force and the Navy have done to the island, along with the preparatory fires of the Armada of the United States Navy, which, I mean, was not, which was big. Anyway, 3rd division will then more than likely, like, move north to see what's going on in Okinawa and maybe be utilized there. If not there, because we should handle that too, they'll be ready and rested and ready for the invasion of mainland Japan. So anyway, that's the scheme maneuver. So, like, what, a day or two into it, 3rd division gets told, your shit's going ashore, boys. Get ready. So, but if you look at, there's some great stories from the right flank near the boat basin of the landing beaches. Those guys don't go fucking anywhere for like a month. They fight in the meat grinder, the amphitheater, and Turkey Knob up there. They essentially, they land and they hang a right. And over the course of the next 6 weeks, they go nowhere. And they get it on a fucking daily basis. And there's a great story, I wish I could remember the guys' names, of there's a CO and OPSO. And they've been together on like Tinian or Saipan, right? Maybe it was Saipan.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it couldn't have been Saipan. Well, maybe because they'd have been part of it.
I know who you're talking about. They were raiders together too.
Right, and they one of them gets shot in the chest. Right, he's got a second chest wound, and I think it's a CO. And the OPSO comes up to him, and he's on the stretcher, and goes, "Hey, get the fuck up!" And he's like, "You were hurt worse on Tinian, man. Yeah, what the fuck?" He's like, "What are you gonna cheese dick out of this thing?"
That guy became the CO of the basic school in the 50s, man. The guy, the colonel. The guy at the CO. I can't remember his name, though.
Yeah, I wish I could.
I remember that story. Yeah.
I wish I could. And you're reading it, you're like, but these guys are like hard, hard, hard guys. But over on the right flank, I want to say it's 25th Marines on the right flank, 24th and 25th Marines. That pivot right, and if you look, if you watch like the movement of the battle on a daily basis, right, on the left side of the island and up the island, you know, they move, right? You see them get stopped by Hill 362 Alpha, right? And then when they get on the north side of Airfield Number 2, right, they're going into the terrain gets broken and mutually supporting and a fucking nightmare. But if you look on the right flank, that shit doesn't move at all until towards the latter part of the battle. And it is, I mean... And that's where you hear General Zinni talk about. He goes, you know what Recon did on Iwo Jima? They were in rear area security. What else are you going to do with them? Put them in front of your lines by 3 meters?
Yeah, right.
And so...
The Commandant's dad, or his uncle, rather, was the CO of that 5th Corps Amphibious Company.
Really?
Yeah. And his uncle was the CO of... of 1-6 in Tarawa, the guys who came ashore on rubber boats. And, I wish I could remember that guy's name you were talking about, that colonel.
That's hilarious.
Because I'm going down, you know, duty at the basic school. I'm going down looking at all the guys who were COs. And that guy, and he was a young-looking colonel, you know, because they had him in his basic school picture, snotty-looking guy, you know what I mean? I can't remember his name, but it's worth looking up later for sure.
No, but I mean, that story over there is pretty unbelievable in terms of the fighting. Well, any other Tim? Anything else about Iwo Jima? I mean, other than the fact that you were there, anything about the battle that intrigues you more than anything else?
No, it was just that constant slog, and I was going to mention a Zinni comment with the recon. It was one of those things where everybody was truly a rifleman, because what else are you going to do? And like I said, as you move through that terrain, it's awe. That's the only word I can. They're shock and awe for you as walking through that terrain and trying to imagine.
Yeah.
What it must have been like to fight through it. It is a phenomenal testament to the courage and grit, because it wasn't like those guys didn't know what they were walking into. I mean, they knew they were screwed, and they still went. And it's just it makes you proud, but it's just such an awesome battle. But you can't discuss tactics or anything like that, because it would There was not. It's just go forward and kill these guys. Drive, yeah. You know, drive them out of the
hole. I know. Bind them, blind them, yeah. Blind them, burn them, blast them.
And Mac, do you remember? You located the platoon commander of the flag raisers. Keith, was his name Wheeler?
No, Keith Wells.
Wells, that's it. Wells.
He wasn't some of the flag raisers, but he was. All of a sudden, I get a phone call. Somebody calls over IOC from the basic school, and they said, "Hey, this guy that was on a lieutenant on Iwo Jima is coming out. You guys want to have lunch and take him around?"
Yeah.
I was like, "Fuck yeah!" And we had maps up in IOC, and so I go over and meet him. Keith Wells, he's a big guy, still in his like 60s or 70s at the time, and he came over and we got the maps out. Oh my God, it was awesome! And he talked about going across the so he's with 28th Marines, so right at the base of Suribachi. He talks about, you know, he told one story that was awesome that I'll never forget. He's they're going across the base, that kind of the neck of the island, with Suribachi as the head. So they're cutting across the island, and then they're going to get to the far side, and 28th Marines is going to pivot to the left, and then they're going to assault Suribachi. That's the plan. So he says we're about halfway across the island, and they have these pillboxes, man. And there's this big one, and a lot of the earth has been displaced by the naval bombardment and the aerial bombardment. So we see this pillbox, and we can hear him in there. And he said, we got a thermite grenade, right, which cooks off at, what, 5,000 degrees?
Yeah.
Yeah. He said, so we get
underwater, yeah.
Yeah, we get the thermite grenade, and we get it ready, and then we saw where the door was to come out of it, right? So I got my Thompson machine gun, and I was standing, like, outside the door. And you can imagine, he said, there was, like, three of us, you know, two PFCs with their M1 Garands and me with my Thompson machine gun. And he said, that shoots 45 caliber slugs, by the way.
Yeah.
So they throw the thermite grenade in there, and they can hear him screaming. And then the door opens, and he said the smoke billows out, and he said all I could see were feet. And they had those wrapped around their legs, and they had those tabby, is that how you say it, tabby or tabby,
yeah.
Where they had the separate big toe in their shoe. And so he said you could see them come out. They were holding on the bayonet scabbard of the guy in front of them. He said there was about 15 of them, and they came out in this cloud of smoke. And then he said, and I laid them out for inspection.
And they passed.
Yeah, he said, I laid them out with that Thompson machine gun. Boy, that was a good piece of gear. And so then he's talking about they get to the far side of the island, and he said, so, like, we're there, and, you know, it's been a pretty crazy day. And I see, like, I know I'm supposed to put out wire, because that's how we rehearsed, right? So I find some wire, and I start bouncing it out, and he said, I get out in front of my position, I hop back in my hole, and another lieutenant sees me, so he does it, he gets shot and killed. He said, I've never forgot about that. I've always felt bad about that. And, yeah, but he was Keith Wells. He wrote a book called, you know, God, I'll find it here in a second. But, yeah, talk about a really, you know, interesting day that just kind of falls in your lap. Keith Wells and then they went up. And then Iwo Jima Suribachi, after a couple of days of fighting around the base, you know, becomes a non-event as they go up to the top.
Right. Yeah, they didn't think much of what they were doing. But everybody else did, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and the story, especially the second flag raisers, I mean, that's a fucking working party.
Yeah.
Hey, take this flag. Get me the one, because I know somebody's going to fucking – I know some Marine's going to fucking take that thing. I want it. Put this son of a bitch up. All right, sir.
Yeah. But that platoon, those guys, I mean, he had a Medal of Honor. He had a couple Navy crosses out of the 40-plus guys that started out that thing. They really and the book, there's a book by Richard Wheeler. It's a really good book about Iwo Jima, and he talks a lot about Lieutenant Wells. He was in that platoon. And the name of the book is Iwo, but it really has it, you know, it's got like stories about how Wells got in trouble when they're in Libo. The battalion commander is a guy named that guy that we're talking about is named Chambers. Justice Chambers, I think.
That's a big
guy you were talking
Jima?
About.
There's another Chambers that gets killed at the base of Iwo Jima.
That's his battalion commander, Wells's battalion commander.
Right, right. But yeah, that's not the guy who got shot at the boat basin.
Oh, the other guy's name is close to that. It's a CH type name, I think. But anyway, yeah, that book is good, and he talks all that stuff you're talking about. You know, Wells talks about in there. Wells got evacuated. Finally, they had to evacuate him. He got hit, and he couldn't walk anymore, and he got evacuated that way.
The he was awarded the Navy Cross.
Yeah.
Right. Part of the citation reads, "By his leadership and indomitable fighting spirit, First Lieutenant Wells contributed materially to the destruction of at least 25 Japanese emplacements. 25. During this attack, Wells was wounded and evacuated to a hospital ship. He would escape the hospital ship by convincing a corpsman to supply him with sulfa powder and morphine so he could rejoin his platoon shortly after the first flag raising. Once Wells reached the base of Mount Suribachi, he was helped to the summit by one of the flag raisers, Charles Lindbergh, who I fucking met, who signed my company guide on."
Yeah, he's a flamethrower guy.
Yeah, he's the flamethrower guy. If you want to look at a badass-looking dude in the first flag-raising picture, look at the guy, the flag's in the background, and he's like there, big jaw, big shoulders with a flamethrower on him. And let me tell you, that guy wasn't 5'8". But I met him.
No way.
I swear to God, he was from, grew up in East Grand Forks, Minnesota. And after the flood in 1997, it took them about 4 years, and they rebuilt the Veterans Memorial. Well, who do you think dedicated it? Chuck Lindbergh. And I remember walking in there. This is a great fucking story. Thanks for bringing him up. Lindbergh's going to be there. I had interviewed him for the show, kind of to publicize the event. And we talked about Iwo Jima. And he was pissed about the second flag raising. He was pissed till the day he fucking died that the first flag raisers had been largely overlooked in history. And this is before Flags of Our Father and all the rest of that stuff that has since come out. So this was him like telling the story of the first flag raising. And so also there is the president of the University of North Dakota, Tom Clifford, who was a tank commander on Iwo Jima. He was a tank company commander on Iwo Jima. And I played audio of Tom Clifford, and I'll play you here's part of it. This guy who was a platoon commander as a lieutenant, he was in 2-5 when I was in 1-5 as a second lieutenant. He said he met me at a party. He finds me in North Dakota in like 1998. And I'm doing radio, and I wasn't doing radio yet. After, it must have been 2000 because he brings me these CBS cassettes of the Great War. It's got audio from 4th Tank Battalion's tactical net on this shit. And he said, "Hey, do you know Tom Clifford?" And I said, "Yeah." And Clifford was a robust guy. He was a handball player, right? And he got wounded in fucking Saipan by driving over an aerial torpedo that was buried in the ground with a landmine on top of it.
Wow.
Yeah, and he tells his fucking story. He's the only one in the tanks that survives. He gets ejected from the tank, right? The turret blows off. He's ejected. He gets blown through the butterfly handles, and it rips his chest from, like, his neckline to his stomach open. Right?
I mean, 50-cal butterfly.
50-cal butterfly, right? And so he's in an open-air hospital that has, like, concrete walls on the sides, and they run out of general anesthetic. So the two fucking docs, who he knows, right? It's like, "Hey, this is Lieutenant Lynch, and this is Lieutenant Commander Kenny, and they put you on the table," and they're like, "Mac, what's going on?" Like, "I don't know, I'm fucked up." Like, "Yeah, you are. Hey, we're out of general anesthetic, so we're going to have to inject you locally." Okay. And so they're sewing him up, and they're talking to him as they're operating on him, and then one of them looks down and says, "Shit, Tom, your appendix is about to go. You don't care if we take it out, do you?" And he said, "Not at all." So he said, "I felt this like snip, snip, and then I heard this splosh into a bucket, and then they sewed my ass up."
Wow.
Then he gets sent to back to 4th Tank Battalion, and he's on Iwo Jima, and listen to this shit. How this audio survives, I don't know. I bring him on my radio show. I don't tell him I have this audio, and I play this shit for him from Iwo Jima. what's hilarious is the call signs and the way they talk on an open mic, right? And you're going to hear Java Joe looking for Tom, but it's this is amazing that this thing even survived. Now, these are tanks ashore on day one, looking for a gap, a proofed mine lane to get off the beach and up to airfield number one. And then you'll hear a guy named Tom come on, and that's Tom Clifford. And he's sitting in my studio, and I play this for him, and you should have seen the look on his face.
Hello, Bill. This is Steve. Over. All right, Bill, look to your right if you can. And you'll have to see if you can work through those sticks now. They have the mark that Pearson and Clifford went through those. Over.
Fucking calm always sucks, man.
Hello, Dick. Hello, oh, Dick. Calm. This is Steve. Do you receive me? Over. Hello, Tom. Hello, Tom. Do you receive me yet? Over. Hello, Dick. Hello, Dick. This is Steve. Over. Hello, Dick. Hello, Dick. This is Steve. Over. Hello, Dick. Hello, Dick. Hello, Steve. Hello, Steve. This is Dick. Over. Dick. This is Steve. I can't seem to get through to you. I receive you, but I can't seem to put to you. Over.
Applejack, this is 8-Ball. Over.
8-Ball is my friend, Tom Clifford, who passed away a few years ago.
Yeah. Hello, Tom. Hello, Tom. This is Steve. Over.
Hello, Steve. Hello, Steve. This is Tom. Over.
I just talked to Java Joe, and he said to what he knows, they're supposed to be within 100 yards of the airstrip. Over.
We must be right around up here someplace, Steve. There isn't a hell of a lot of infantry here. You know where that's... Those poles are right on the edge of the airstrip, and we're not about 150 to 200 yards away from them. Over.
Roger, Tom. You say your 300s are not working, nor can you contact any infantry? Over.
We tried to contact...
300
the phone. Is that amazing? And so he's sitting there listening to it, and his eyes, like, I don't want to say they gloss over, but you know how you can tell when somebody goes someplace else?
Right.
And then it ends, and he looks at me, and he says, where the hell did you get that? And I said, this lieutenant gave it to me and asked me if I knew you. And so I didn't want to tell you about it. Tell me about that. He then goes into, like, well, we hit the beach, and he looked at me and goes, I got chills listening to that. I said, that's that day. And he said, how did that even, who would be recording our tactical net, and how would it survive somebody throwing it in the garbage? I said, I don't know, but how crazy is that? But Lindbergh, that guy, he's there when I walk in there. And Clifford's a robust guy, even into his 70s. So I walk up behind him, and he liked me, right? So I walked up behind him, and I said, how old are you really? You're not fucking 80 years old. I'm not playing that game that you play with everybody else, and don't think you could bullshit me. And he turns around, he starts laughing. He goes, you know what? He goes... I'd have knocked you right on your ass. I said, let me ask you a question. I said, what were you like when you came home from World War II? He said, oh, fuck, you don't want to know. He said, ask some of the police department guys from here. They'll tell you. He said, they found me more than... He said, I drove my car down the railroad tracks one night and had a little confrontation with them. And I said, what? He said, yeah, it seemed like a good idea. He said, I was liquored up, and then I got out, and I was pissed. And we had a little scuffle on the railroad tracks. He said, and then I had to stop doing stuff like that. I had to stop. But those kind of guys, right? These guys were no shit Saipan Iwo Jima guys, and have a few beers and somebody piss them off. Yeah. And so that day, Lindbergh, I had him sign the guide on that I have sitting here in my studio. And, but he was in Wells's, Wells' platoon. And then when the CO, Chandler Johnson, who gets killed a couple days later, right, he ordered...
He got blown to pieces, man.
Yeah, he ordered Wells back to the company aid station and made Sergeant Boots Thomas, who was killed a few days later.
Another Navy Cross guy, though.
Right, but Wells stayed on the island. But he was, you know, that's how serious his wound was that he couldn't go back. His book is entitled "Give Me 50 Marines Not Afraid to Die, Iwo Jima," and it's about
as he said before.
Yeah.
Before the battle, he said that.
Yeah, he was a big reader too. He had books with him on Iwo Jima that he was reading, but he's a big, tall Texan dude. And little piece of American history. Email. This disjointed discussion is absolutely fascinating, and I don't know where to start. Should I start with the link between global warming and racism that had me spit my coffee out on my lap in my car? or this narrative about Lieutenant Wells. This shit is awesome. I love Wednesdays now.
That other guy's name was Justice Chambers, by the way.
Justice Chambers.
Yep.
The he asked a question. Is it hard for you to believe that it took almost, 75 years for the Marine Corps to get the name straight of those flag raisers?
That was an amazing story. That was an amazing story. What's even harder to believe, was it an Irish guy that did all the digging around?
Here's
the mom recognized her son and said, "That's my son's ass."
That's amazing too.
You know, then no one could remember because so many guys got killed. I mean, I think the original flag raising, three guys got killed. And the second flag raising, three guys got killed on Iwo Jima there. So that's half the people. I mean, then you get guys like Ira Hayes, he's an alcoholic guy, and he dies later. And, like you were saying, Mac, it's a working party, the second one. So it's like, who remembers that shit, you know?
Well, and here's the thing I think about shit like this, right? Bradley, if you look at the pictures, right, when you the way this thing comes about is this guy on disability leave from Ireland who's a World War II maniac who loves the Marine Corps, and there's an interview with him here on All Marine Radio, and he's just a wonderful guy.
Wow.
And he gets kind of screwed out of all this stuff because other people take control of it and sign contracts for specials, and he's kind of left out of it. I want to see his first name, Stephen. Is it Grady? I can't remember his last name. I'll remember. It'll come to me. Anyway, he's looking at pictures, and I want Timmy's opinion about this. So then finally the Omaha World Herald takes this stuff, and they publish this article about it. And they have these blow-up pictures in the article that when you hover your mouse over the picture, it explodes, right?
Uh-huh.
You see the pictures of John Bradley on Mount Suribachi that day, and his uniform is so distinct. You look at the pictures for 30 seconds, and you're like, holy shit, Bradley's not in the flag raising. There's no way. Bradley's wearing his leggings, his pants are cuffed, and he's wearing his Unit 1s, for lack of a better term. I don't know what they called them in World War II. But he's wearing two Unit 1s, bandolier style, across his over his shoulders. Now, you look at the flag-raising picture, and there's nobody close to that. And so Bradley, as he's sitting at those, as he does the war bond tour, right? He gets told, hey, you're in that. Well, I know I was up there that day, right? And the picture sucks. And, maybe that's me. But then the more he looked at that picture, I believe he knew he wasn't in the motherfucker.
Yeah.
And then when you look at the statue, the sculpture, and you look at that, if I gave both you guys your 782 gear right now and threw it at your feet and said, put that shit together, boys, you would probably be able to come to pretty close to the way you wore it in 1985, 86. Yes?
Yes.
You don't forget how you wore your shit. So Bradley looks at that statue, and he sees wire cutters on the guy's hips. He sees no leggings, right? He sees the pants not cuffed. And what does he conclude? That ain't fucking me. But he can't tell anybody, right?
Right.
Like, I'm going to be that guy? And I went on this, I masqueraded as this guy? And so he goes up to Appleton, Wisconsin, and becomes an undertaker, and he never talks about it again, hardly at all. But he does great things the rest of his life, and he's a Navy Cross recipient.
Yeah, yeah.
And then his fucking kid writes a book.
Yeah, how about that?
And then, like, his kid gets the rug pulled out from underneath him. Hey, guess what? Your dad ain't in the fucking thing. It's amazing.
I didn't even know about any of this. This is the first time hearing it.
Really?
Yeah.
And so, you know, what happens is Bradley's wounded bad, and he's in Guam, and they send a message because I think Gagnon says, yeah, that's Bradley, that's Hayes. Hayes said he'd kill him. If you tell them I'm in that fucking picture, I'll kill you. So he gives up all the names that he thinks in him, except Hayes. He won't give up Hayes. And the Lieutenant Colonel PAO at Headquarters Marine Corps says, hey, listen, Gagnon. You want to go to the fucking brig? We think we're gonna play fucking games with you and that long fucking bouffant hairdo you got going? We're not. Okay? This is the PAO. Right? This is the main effort of the Marine Corps, goddammit. And Gagnon, he crumbles. He's like, his name's Hayes, Ira Hayes. He's like, all right, so get Hayes, get Bradley. So Bradley gets told you gotta go to DC. Grainy ass fucking photo. Well, I don't know, maybe it was me. And so then it's like, all right, here's what we need for you boys. You guys are all in the picture. You're going to do the war bond drive, okay? And they go do that thing, and they go through the whole, you're a hero, we're really a working party, right? And all that shit. Hayes is getting drunk out of his mind. But Bradley, you know what I mean? Over the course of time, right, you know your uniform, and you're looking at that, and you're going, fuck, that isn't me.
Yeah.
And so that must have been horrible for that guy. And if you look at pictures of him at the dedication, like whenever they dedicated, like in 56 or whatever the fuck, 52, I don't know what it was. He's wearing these horn rimmed glasses, and he looks like somebody shoved like a case of grapefruits up his ass.
Yeah, he's really. But you know, again, I believe all that you just said. That makes sense now. But you know, he also was a son. In the book that his son wrote, he's writing about when he comes back from Japan, or he's reading about Japan. He's talking about how more superior they are to the American culture because of the respect they have for family and the respect they have for, you know, for courtesy and stuff. And this is and the dad doesn't say a word, even after they had lost that guy, that kid who was captured by the Japanese, pulled underground and tortured to death. And you know, they find out about that later, but he never talks about it.
Right.
He never upbraids his son and says, what are you, high? Let me tell you a little bit about Japanese culture from my point of view.
Right.
That's what I probably would have done, or any of us might have done, but he doesn't. He just lets the kid talk.
Well, you know, Bradley didn't make the claim. He kind of was overcome by events by the time
he
would have realized it, you know. Yeah. And the same thing happened. Remember that picture from Tet? Where you got the guys on a tank, and he's on a board on a tank, and there's a Marine holding an IV bottle, and he's got a squid in his helmet.
Right.
That's being argued to this day, because it's been misidentified all the way up until Mark Bowden's recent book, and there was another photographer there who caught the sequence of the Marine being wounded. That guy ultimately died. But he's been misidentified up until – they're still arguing about it. I mean, I read an article about it yesterday. It's shit gets confused, and I feel sorry for Bradley. That must have just sucked. But at some point, you know, you've got to kind of go with it, because what else do you do?
Yeah.
Well, especially, I mean, back then, so what Bradley would have had to done is issue some kind of statement and said, hey, you know, I'd never meant to deceive anybody. I was told that was me, Lieutenant Colonel, PAO, which is the main effort of the Marine Corps. He threatened me, and so I went along. I'm really sorry, but I just want to be honest that that isn't me. Could you imagine? I mean, like, look, I'm not going there. I'm not doing that. If they say that's me, and I'm just not going to talk about it. And, you know, and he rarely did. He would do, like, local stuff, where, because he was a proud veteran, right? He's a Navy Cross recipient. And, I mean, you hear Lindbergh get shot on the northern end of the island. He gets shot through the femur, but he knows not through the femur. What's the bone in your upper arm?
Ulnar radius. The ulnar radius. Something else.
There you go. Timmy Corman. Doc Lynch. Hey. Oh, Doc Lynch. But he knows it's a through and through wound, and he goes down and he looks at it, and he said he saw Bradley get up to come to him. And he said he couldn't get up right away, and he's screaming at Bradley, "No, I'm fine." And he said, and through a hail of gunfire, here comes John Bradley. Yeah. And that's the kind of, like, I mean, and let me tell you, how Corman that went through those battles are ever right in the fucking head after that?
Yeah.
And they're not. I mean, they faked it, right? The shit those guys did, and in fact, the interview you're going to hear after this with Cal Humphrey, he's going to talk about his son, you know, asking him, how come you never talked about it? And he says, what am I going to tell him? That I gave one of my best friends morphing shots and watched him bleed to death because nobody could come help him? Like, why do I want to talk about that with my kid? You know? Did I clean my rifle with the same toothbrush that I brush my teeth with? Did I wipe my ass with my hand and use the volcanic ash to get it off, which is really good to get stuff like that off your hand? He said, you know, I would never just talk about that stuff with my family.
Right. So,
really interesting. Really, really, really interesting stuff in terms of what those guys went through. And that to me, so I look at John Bradley now as a tragic figure almost. Just, you know, as courageous and selfless as the day is long, went back to his community and was a great guy in his community, but lived with a burden of the PAOs fucking it up like they always do.
And I don't think he ever told his kid he even got the Navy Cross. I think he didn't find out until after he passed.
Well, you know what, and the story is when you read the book that he reads a letter that his dad writes to his mom, I think, or maybe his parents, the day after the flag raising, when they're still up atop Suribachi. And did you like the way I used atop there? That's kind of literary, didn't you think?
You're a storyteller, man.
Carried it off good, too. I didn't even notice.
Did you see me slide that in? It was kind of like Homer-esque, or who wrote Moby Dick?
Herman Melville.
There you go. I knew Kenny knows that kind of shit. He's like Rain Man. He's got this fucking memory from hell, right? You can ask him, like, what are the ingredients of Purina cat food salmon variety? And he'll fucking tell you. Mac, cornmeal, salmon, water.
An arm bone, which is really the correct name for that bone that in your upper arm, the arm bone.
There you go. And ask Rain Man about the mafia. Talk about
it. Oh, geez, fuck.
Geez.
Yeah. Yeah, filibuster. You want a filibuster? Say the word soprano in front of Kenny and just get out of the fucking way. See? All right, but we're talking about Iwo Jima. Yeah, so that's how I look at Bradley. I look at him as this great American who the PAOs of the Marine Corps fucked up, and he had to live with it forever. And then his son, I mean, he writes his book, he tours the world, Clint Eastwood makes a movie out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like, yeah, everybody that's in is actually in it except Bradley. What?
Yeah.
Oops. Yeah. Sorry. Never mind. Right? Candy Graham. Let's see.
So that makes the part in the movie and in the book where the mom says, "That's my boy. That's not this other guy."
Right.
And Bradley's talking to her, and he's like, and it kind of gets overshadowed by the Ira Hayes, who's drunk, kind of going to tears with the old lady about the kid, you know. But
you know, it's to me, one of the things that's interesting about that whole thing is, like, we can be around it, right? And guys get killed, and we have memorial services, right? And then what do? We go try to find who did it, and we try to kill them and kill everybody connected with it, right? Because that's all you can do. But when you see their wife and kids, that's different, right? And the story is these guys are in Philadelphia, and these mothers show up. Mike Strank's mother, right? And Hayes just loses it when he sees Mike Strank's mom about Mike Strank was a father figure to Ira Hayes. And it's just, I mean, I'd be curious your thoughts about that, because it's like opening this door, that a place that we don't really want to go. Like, we could look at each other and we know it fucking sucks, but it's what we chose, and we'll go get our fucking payback. But when you see their moms and their wives and their kids, fuck, that's fucking horrible.
Yeah, it is.
It is. Yeah. You know, at least with Bradley, I read an interesting story from a guy who was hunting down the story of his grandfather, who apparently had been an abusive drunk and horrible, but often the only thing he would talk about was his time as an Army tanker was the attack on Kakazoo Ridge, which he would say 20 tanks went out and 3 tanks came back. And this guy spends years, even goes to Okinawa, trying to retrace his grandfather's steps to understand. And when he finally gets what was left of the records, because most of those records were destroyed in a fire in the 1970s, his service record, it turns out his father was a replacement guy, wasn't fed into the battle until a week or so after Kakazoo Ridge. So he's like, holy smokes, my grandfather was lying about this the whole time, and which maybe he was. But then on the other hand, he still had a month of slogging through to the end of Okinawa as a tanker to get through, and you can almost see where the guy is. I mean, it's hard to fault the grandfather for starting that, because it's hard to know what to make of some of this stuff because the consequences that roll down through your families or whatnot from these experiences are so profound. I just don't know what to say, although I would cut his grandfather a little bit of a break, because I can't imagine being an Army tanker at the end of that battle was very pleasant, needless to say.
Well, and I would, I have this to say about that. It's one thing if he was, right, handling cargo down on the beach. But when we're talking about, oh, yeah, he got there the week after, okay, look, that's still baller central, okay? So, and who's to say the fucking clerk got that right to begin with?
Yeah, that's the other thing I was going to say.
Those monkeys.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you. Thank you. We cleared that up. There is no stolen valor there. Yeah, that's like you want to hear a cool Marine Corps story?
Yes.
A guy I know who was with 3-7 in Ramadi, Roger Turner, commanding in 2005. If I've told you guys the story, tell me, and I won't tell it. But named Ben Lunick. They're getting ready to go on patrol. His buddy, best friend, corporal by the name of Van Alstein, is got the 240 going to the vehicle. He says, hey, Van, do you care if I gun today? And he says, no. So Ben finishes his cigarette, grabs a 240, puts it in the Humvee. They roll. Van Alstein's driving. They roll over an IED, detonates just aft of the front left tire, kills Van Alstein, launches Ben Lunick 13 years ago, a month ago, out of the vehicle. He's a below-the-knee amputee. And he's got to live with that, right? So some people have survivor's guilt, like, why did they die and I not? Ben doesn't have that kind of guilt. He knows the reason his friend died was because his friend said, yeah, I don't care if that's what you want to do, and he's alive. And, you know, and that's some serious shit, right? So he never received his combat action ribbon from being in 3-7. He said, he's telling me the story, and he says, hey, but Mac, I wore the motherfucker. Yeah, stolen valor. I said, bro, it ain't stolen valor if you raid it. Right? It's stolen valor if you don't. He goes, yeah, well, it was fucking with my head, man. It was fucking with my head. So it takes him 4 years to become a cop. He's got to be able to pass a physical, and he could. He has to get his finances in order. He's got to get a degree. So he does all that. He becomes a cop in Colorado. As he's getting ready to get commissioned and get his badge as a police officer, they stop the ceremony.
Yeah, he did tell me this.
He's like, what the fuck?
It's good, though. It's good.
Right? And they come out, and they read attention to orders. They read the citation for his combat action ribbon. And they present it to him. Then he gets his badge. He's like, one of the greatest days of my life, man.
I bet.
Right?
Awesome story. Isn't it?
Isn't it? I mean, yeah. and he had told the story to, I guess, some Marine major that he met who was doing something. And I don't know if the guy was either part of the reserves or part of recruiting in Colorado. And that dude went and made that happen, which is kind of a cool story. So, anyway,
yeah.
I share it with you. Email, Jeff and Tim Auer. Did any of you guys run across Laura Logan in your deployments? I followed her a while on 60 Minutes, but I had no idea she ran with the Northern Alliance right after 9/11, nor did I know that she was running the streets of Ramadi with Marines. She's a baller. I don't know if you saw the interview that she did. That it's about it's about 3.5 hours. If you haven't seen the whole thing, put it on your list of things to watch because she tells the truth, and she's pretty fucking blunt. And she's a stud, and so
I'm a fan, definitely.
Did you ever meet her?
No.
Yeah, I never did either. I don't know if she was in Ramadi in 2004, and I would because Oliver North was there. Because everybody, the reason I know those things is because they would all want to come and talk to General Mattis, General Kelly, right. And not so much Colonel Dunford because he was just a colonel. Right. But they would all kind of cycle through, and I would be responsible for that. So I didn't run across her. Tim, did you ever run across her in your travels?
I did not, but I once wrote a blog post that tore into her 60-minute interview with the Special Forces. Oh. And I think in a post I put something about it was like listening to a child trying to explain quantum physics because I found the whole thing to be that disturbing, the whole article, and now I feel bad because I don't know it. And the interview was just, it was a collection of errors that I just found appalling.
Was that the Benghazi? And, was that the Benghazi thing?
No. Okay. She embedded the story was called the Quiet Professionals, and it was SF guys training supposedly Afghan commandos, and it was a whole bunch of stuff. I mean, the way they were treating them was pretty bad. They shoot two kids with edit. But one of the guys pulling sentries pops a couple of kids in the back of a truck because he fired at the truck saying it was warning shots, but he had a suppressed weapon. I mean, it was a lot to pick apart there, but it just seemed like she. Yeah. I feel bad now because she went through a lot, and I enjoyed listening to that interview. And but that's the only thing I have with her.
Yeah, so she was. Yeah, when you. I didn't know she was in Ramadi, but again, when was she in Ramadi? 2005, 2006? Because it was on in Ramadi for a few years. But supposedly she spent like 4 years in Iraq. Yeah, wow. She's got, thrill seeker girl from South Africa. But she made news around the country here recently in an interview with a SEAL, Mike Ritland. Right. He does a podcast called Mike Drop. And they are friends from when he was on active duty, evidently. And so she did this thing where she called out the American media and said, look, 85% of them are registered Democrats, and 14 to the next 15% are simply too lazy to go register. So, I mean, that's what you're looking at. And when anything is skewed like that, the coverage is going to be skewed. And then she made all these interesting points. She says, these things that go viral, why do they go viral? Is it a grassroots thing? Or is it that somebody wrote an algorithm at Facebook or YouTube that takes this content and makes it go viral? She said, and so if you don't ask those questions, which people don't, then what you have is you have stupid. And so, I mean, so the interview is, really refreshing because, you know, we talk about all the time that, you know, does the truth matter anymore?
Right.
You know? Doesn't matter anymore. And the painful part of it is that a lot of us think it doesn't matter anymore. And that sucks, man. It straight up sucks. So, anyhow.
It does.
Anyhow. All right. Go.
No, I was just going to say, she also did a 60-minute piece a couple years ago on Kabul, which I wrote about on the blog, and I praised her to high heaven. She was very, very blunt with the State Department people and whatnot as they tried to put lipstick on the pig.
Right.
Of Kabul as it is. I mean, you know, I got to fly a mile to the airport, for God's sakes. It's right. She is an amazing journalist.
Well, again, to me, what was most refreshing is that she's straight up telling the truth.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It seemed to me, I mean, when you listen to her, and I'll tell you what I really liked was, you know, when he asked her about the war in Iraq, he said, you know, she said, you know, the thing that hasn't been well covered, and it's kind of interesting, is not only was us going to war there, you know, she said, you know, done with shaky grounds, and so, and she kind of walks through, you know, her analysis of that. She said, but the way we left after we encouraged all these institutions and all this change in Iraq, we just unasked the son of a bitch under President Obama, and nobody said a word. And what that did to that country when we did that, she said, is still hasn't been appropriately described for the American people. And yeah. she said, and then she got, and this is just like a punch in the gut. Actually, it's a baseball bat to the chest when you hear her say that. She said, you know, in Iraq and Afghanistan, there's a saying, the only thing worse than having America as your enemy is having them for your friend. Ouch, right? Fuck.
Yeah, you don't have to justify the truth, right?
Right, no. It lands with a thud and needs no saleswoman. All right. Final thoughts on Iwo Jima. As we always remember this time of year, either a book to read, something that you find interesting and are still reading about. Jeff?
Oh, that book by Richard Wheeler, Iwo. I mean, I still go back to it, you know, periodically, because
now, and Wheeler was with who?
He was with that platoon from Echo Company 228.
Oh, all right. So yeah. He was there.
Yep.
And the book is called
Iwo.
Iwo
by Richard Wheeler
with red letters, right? IWO. I think
it was like they showed a picture of on the cover of that from the sea picture of the like escarpment right by Suribachi. That you see, they showed that picture, and then later on, that's where they were in the movie. That's where they were like swimming during a break,
right?
During the time, yeah.
All right.
But that's pretty good.
All right, Tim. Anything?
I'm in response to your question earlier before we came on about something interesting that's current event wise.
Oh yeah.
Am I ready for that?
Yeah.
Yeah. You ready? You ready for what I want to discuss? Universal basic income. Look at that response. Oh, yeah. Now, we're not talking Iwo Jima. I'm responding to what Max said about having something current event-wise or Marine Corps-wise, right? And having been in the trucking industry and whatnot, we're, what, 5-10 years away from automated trucking. They've got AI machines now that can pick strawberries, for crying out loud. We are 10 years away from a lot of jobs. To include even, they've got better AI. AI can read x-rays and sonograms better than humans can, because it can detect different colors of gray. We're about to face a lot of job loss due to automation. And there's, I don't know of anybody that's planning to do anything or has a viable plan outside of Democratic presidential contender Andrew Yang, who you've probably never heard of, right?
Is that a joke?
Because you don't listen to the Rogan podcast. Andy Yang is an entrepreneur who made a killing. He also is a tech guy. He's a Chinese-American guy. He says, I'm an Oriental man that loves math. He calls himself the anti-Trump. But I listen to him articulate universal basic income. I'm like, giving people money for nothing, I don't buy it. But what his plan was to put a value-added tax on, like, particularly the tech companies, because remember, Google paid no taxes this year. A value-added tax, which he rebates to every American over 18, calling it a freedom dividend. And as you listen to him explain what's coming down the road as far as automation and job loss, it's rather terrifying. And I went from absolutely dismissing the thought of giving people money for nothing to, holy smokes, this guy at least has a plan and is addressing a problem that's on the horizon that nobody else is willing to talk about. And I think it's an important one.
That is interesting, for sure.
Really?
Yeah.
You think it's interesting?
Yeah, I throw it up on you. This is Wednesday. We're going to have Jeff Rowe and Tim on. You're going to get stuff like that. Right out of left field, bro. There it is.
Yeah.
That's if you're in an industry that whatever you're doing can be replicated.
Right.
Right? But if you're like me, there is no substitute. There's no mechanical substitute for me.
There isn't. But if you're a lawyer, they're going to have. They're going to be automating most basic.
They should. They should automate lawyers. You want to know why?
Right. Yes, lawyers are crooks.
Exactly.
Lawyers, doctors.
No.
There's no automated
coming down the road.
Replacement for me either. And thank God for that.
Nobody knows Soprano history and the history of the mafia like our Sicilian friend, Jeff Kennedy.
And that's another thing. I'm half Italian, but my relatives were from Abruzzi. It's like southern Italy, but not that south.
Yeah, you know, the Sicilians among the Italians are looked down upon. I don't know if most people know that, but when...
It's the most organized crime in America is Sicilians and Nablodons. You know, people from what they call the Mezzogiorno. It's like the lower half of Italy.
Yeah, the Italians, mm-hmm. They look at that part of the country and go, yeah, not so much. Not so much.
I was going to talk about the Marine Corps needs to relook at roles and missions as we come to the end of this series of conflicts, because the Navy is running out of amphib ships and does not seem anxious to make more. So consequently, we're going to have to either reshape the way we do our thing.
We already have, though. When was the last time somebody wrote an amphib other than into a port to get off and stretch and go?
They use the amphibs as platforms for ISR. I mean, we got a couple of pieces of technology that have changed the game a little bit. I mean, one of them is the Osprey.
Right.
The other one is there's new radar and drone systems that really make things interesting. You can basically stretch that golden hour by the stuff you put in an Osprey if you have conflict. I'm talking hundreds of miles from the sea, but launched from ships, you know?
Right. Which is the whole, you know, if you tank an Osprey, right? If you can tank an Osprey, you can do it from forever away, right? And that's how you seize, and you're not going to go, we're not door kicking Iwo Jima anytime soon, right? We're going to see something adjacent to Iwo Jima, and then, right, we're going to go from there. And so it's going to be a soft entry. It's going to get built up with air power projected over the top of it, and all that kind of shit.
Yeah. And do you need 2,500 guys to do that? You know, and do they have the ability to put that many people at sea? Because one thing that is inescapable about doing stuff the way we do, power projection from the sea, is that anywhere from 7 to 15 miles out, it's anybody's land out there in the ocean. So you can squat there with, you know, pretty capable force and not do anything but let our presence be known. And so then it becomes and always has been, kind of like the dichotomy between using uniformed police who are evident on the streets and then undercover police who are trying to catch criminals. You wonder which ones, the truth is both of them are effective, but you don't know how many crimes are stopped by having that uniformed guy walking the beat. But the thing with the Muse, you don't know how many things don't develop into crises because these guys are there and, you know, all of a sudden they're off to a guerrilla in West Africa or, you know, a terrorist in Southern Arabian Peninsula. He looks out there, he sees those amphibs and maybe a couple of pointy ships with him, and it looks like D-Day to him. So, and you don't know how much of that stuff, how many bad things don't happen because of that.
It is D-Day. And you're a Mew guy, so you want to be an amphib guy. But again, the Navy has been trying to reduce and give away, and that is one of the first things they offer up. Hey, well, we won't do amphibs then.
Right. And you got to ask yourself then, what's the point of a Marine Corps if we're not going to do that? What else?
Second Land Army.
Who needs two? We just have a bigger one.
You don't want one. You don't want. You got to have two, so that you make them compete.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if you can articulate that.
Yeah.
You know, then fine. But I don't know if we have people who are willing to articulate.
Hey,
that.
We don't have a Marine Corps because we need one. We have a Marine Corps because the American people want one. Now I don't know who I heard say that, but I've heard.
Krulak. You're a Krulak.
Yeah, that's Krulak.
You're a Krulophile. Yeah, those maniac monks. Probably right. Not. I'm not one of those guys.
But he said, his dad said that in that book, First to Fight.
Yeah, the Krulak, hey, the Krulak family, they are the jihadists, okay? Just so you know. They are the warrior maniacs. We don't go out. We don't drink whiskey. We pray and we read books. And we only have sex for procreation periods, for procreation reasons, not for recreational reasons.
Yeah.
I'm out.
Me too. And I am out now. And we all are.
On that comment, we're everybody getting out. Go ahead, Tim. You were going to say. Tim's undaunted by that shit. Go ahead.
I was going to say. No, do you know that the Commandant's Krulak's brother was a chaplain? You do know that, right?
I just saw him give a benediction someplace. Yes. At the General Officers Symposium. Was that where I saw it? I saw. Yeah, they introduced him like Father Krulak. I was like, what? Did they say Krulak? And like when they said Krulak, like, I don't know if it was me, but it seemed to me like the light pigmentation changed in the room. I was like, oh, shit. These Krulak people, they have some, major aura shit going on. So I was like, who is this guy?
Now, and can I also make a comment about we have a Marine Corps because the American public wants one, which was once true. But I would say now that the biggest argument against a democracy is spending 5 minutes talking to somebody who's a member of the public now with the democracy, because basically trying to say that I don't think enough Americans even know who the Marine Corps is these days.
Yeah.
It's not like when we were kids. And so I don't believe we can rest on our laurels and think that that's always going to be the case, because it's not the case now. It was when we were kids.
Well, what are we going to do? What does the Marine Corps do to change that, right? Start doing rap music with their recruiting shit? Oh, shit, the Army's already doing that.
So I don't think that's a good idea.
Yeah, we can't be second. And so I say, look, it's not a bad thing if the Marine Corps goes away. I mean, we love the Marine Corps, but you know what? Maybe its time has come and gone. Maybe it's time for us to roll it all up and say, happy trails, man.
You know, I have to tell you, I knowing you, I sense you're trying to piss us off. But
what?
I have to tell you, I've thought about that myself a lot. Like, if we're not what we used to be, then what's the point of being? And now people would say, yeah, it's easy for you sons of bitches to say you're retired.
Right.
You know, but I feel that a lot. So if we have to do this to survive, we got to do, you know, certain things in regards to the type of, standards we have for our combat arms folks that make it, you know, pointless to even exist, because it already exists.
Now you're attaching your own personal agenda to a much broader issue, and you need to stop that.
Yeah, you're right.
That shit works for monkeys like Lynch, because he's not paying attention because he's making coffee right now. But I'm fucking paying attention, and so your own little narrow agenda, don't even go there with me.
You don't know how narrow it is, man.
I know you. I don't know. It's very narrow.
Gender discrimination leads straight to racism, and the next thing you know, you don't believe in climate change, and you're...
And you got a polar vortex, and then what do we...
What do you mean there's physical differences between the sexes?
No, I would...
Combat polar vortexes. You get close to somebody from a different sex.
Exactly. What do you mean by that? Nothing. Candy Graham. Did I say that?
No,
I thought I just thought it.
No, I was going to say you could make an argument about these two armies. I think you could make an argument to put most of the Army in reserve status and only have on the active component of Marine Corps, and you could have done that better, like after Grenada and Panama, based on strictly a comparison of performance. Than you can to this day, because obviously the Army had some units that stepped up and fought like lions.
Well, you
can
maybe
18 years,
maybe you bring a portion of the Marine Corps into you expand MARSOC, because they're doing all the fighting anyway, and everything else goes into the reserves to include the Army.
I'll tell you,
I think you could make that successful. Yeah, and leave, and make the active postpone it all mail because, you know, because it's efficient. But
thing you don't want to lose with the Marine Corps is its grit, right? If you look at the Marine Corps historically, the Marine Corps has an edge to it. And you don't want to lose that out of your armed forces because, look, I mean, the Navy, come on, man, that's straight up scary. They're trying to claw back, but God only knows if they'll ever become a military service, right? The Air Force, they're in terms of civilianization, they're in front of the Navy in terms of that glide path. And I will tell you what, that is why Secretary Mattis leaving was so detrimental to the nation. Not in anything current event, but long term, if he could have kept his hands on the DOD, the reformation period, in my opinion, that would have taken place with our sister services that they sorely need, beginning with a headline today in Stars and Stripes, if you're non-deployable for more than 12 months, time for you to leave.
Right.
Right? And his articulate discussion of why transgender people don't belong. Not because we hate them, because, come on, everybody would love to have transgender people in the unit because it would be a fucking scream, okay? But they've got physical issues and there's mental health issues associated with them that they need treatment for, right? And if they go down that road, they're incompatible with military service, just like if you blow your fucking shoulder out. And Secretary Mattis made that articulate, you know, and he commissioned a study and all the rest of that shit. But ultimately, he did what was in the nation's best interest. And him leaving early, not a good thing.
Well, there's no argument for me.
Anyway, when you're talking transgender people, what percentage of the population are we talking about?
Yeah, you're right, Timmy.
Does it matter? Does it matter? It doesn't matter! If it's one person, it's too many!
Pretty good at that, man.
I hear it. I hear that voice screaming at me. And let me tell you, if it's global warming and racism, it applies to everything! We can do it! We just have to work harder together!
I thought you were Donna Petite for a minute there, man. But
who's Donna Petite?
She's Bob Petite's first wife. And she was one of Krulak's, she was a Marine captain and a major.
Uh-oh.
Krulak was always pushing her forward. She testified for Congress, her and Bergeron, the disgraced Bergeron.
Who's disgraced?
Oh, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, I was thinking Bergeron, not Petite. No, I know who you're talking about.
Yeah.
Because one of them went on to end up getting out.
Yeah.
On her terms, after getting busted in an adulterous relationship, but then she turned around and said, let me give you a list of the people I've slept with, and they're like, okay, you can leave.
Yeah.
We're not saying nothing.
Yeah, I had, like, adultery, really. What is this, the Middle Ages, all of a sudden? Like, we're, like, in the Marine Corps, we're going to start charging people with adultery? Really? Really?
Start. You've been doing that for
come
you
know, on. Yeah, the selective prosecution of adultery. Come on, boys.
You're right.
Exactly. Well, she got prosecuted because they recorded her in the 3rd Battalion Command, bad mouth in the regimental command. That's what they got called in front for. And then it was,
Yeah, I mean, come on. Look, I mean, really? You want to pull back the curtain on this shit? Really? Is that, you want to do that? You want to go there? No.
Donna Petite, though, I was just saying that we used to have intellectual discussions with her, you know, from the time we were all in Lejeune together and then up to Quantico, you know, when we were captains. There's no scandal or anything like that related to her that I know of. I mean, her and Bob split up.
No, there's not.
You know, yeah.
All right. Well, that's good to know. It's good to know.
Krulak really, he pushed her out. Like I said, she was in front of Congress along with I can't remember if Kathy Bergeron or Karen Bergeron, but I know there's just both of them were on TV there during the time we were at IOC.
And what were they talking about?
They're talking about, they were the Marine Corps' response to integration juxtaposed against the fact that Tailhook had hit the...
Those idiots.
Yeah.
And I remember when I was an SPC, before I came over to IOC, General Krulak came down.
Right.
And he was talking about you know, being in the head next to Donna Petite. And he goes, is there anybody here that thinks a woman can't do what a man can do? And I could see my lieutenants, they're kind of looking at me, and one of them was going to raise his hand. And I'm like, God. And then he goes, because if you do, I'm running you out of my Marine Corps today.
And Dave stood up to him. If you remember, we're all in the – they're trying to get us to later on in in the auditorium there at TBS. I think you were already gone by then, Mac, but General Krulak was trying to get us to get rid of the Peary valve system that we had in the basic school, which is one of the truth tellers to how a guy or a person is,
right,
is by his peers. And Dave stood up and he locked horns with General Furness, then Captain Furness, locked horns with little Krulak, you know, General Krulak.
Why did he want to, what would be the point of removing spirit?
Because the women were getting perennially marked at the bottom of the squad.
Oh, now I see. Look, here's the deal. It's just like a news story. If what's coming out is not going to be good for us, what do we do? What the Secretary of Navy did with the gender integration study,
yeah,
that was done at 29 Palms, you assassinate the study.
That was Donald Lejeune, but you're right. That's exactly what he did.
Right. So that's what you do. So he did. So yeah, let's do that because, you know, God forbid we should tell the truth and we should all, mm-hmm, have to live with it. Because again, here's my point. Look, this is the United States, right? And in the United States, we're supposed to be equal. Okay, then we do have standards and you have to meet them. We're not bringing the standard to you. For those unicorns out there that can do this shit, that's fine. But there are physical differences. We all know it. That's why they have a separate set of physical requirements in order to make them competitive for promotion.
Right.
That's why that exists. That's the affirmative action piece, because there's physical differences between genders. Okay? And so, like, now you want to eliminate it? Now you want to do away with the things? And so if you could do all that shit, that's fine. Come on in. The water's warm. We'd love to have you. Right?
Yeah.
We're all taking a dump. We'd love to have a girl taking a dump. Right? It would be interesting. Same with transgender people. Yeah. Well, hey, what's Larry going out as tonight? I don't know. Let's walk over and find out.
Is he Larry or Linda?
Yeah. We'd have a couple beers and, like, watch Larry put on his nylons and his garters, man. Hey, Larry, I think the boat, what did Kevin Costner say? The rose goes in front, right? And so, it would be interesting. But you got to be able to do the work. And if you want to fairy dust it, you weaken everybody and more people are going to die.
Yep. And you'll fail.
And
most important.
And remember when he tried to do away with the Mercress hike, which I think they've already done away with. And then Drew Watson organizes his commander's time and works up, and he does a full Mercress hike. He said, see, there's plenty of room in the POI to work your way up to a Mercress hike. And what happened to him for that?
What happened?
Yeah, you're right.
Done.
He'd be in there eating chow in the morning, talking to Drew's lieutenants and cultivating the guys who were bitchy. Well, I don't see why our company has to do stuff that the integrated companies don't have to do, because by some weirdness, he had no females in his company, and he trained them like the way he was trained when he went through the base school.
And no FMOs.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
Well, again, it's just, it's hard because, and then you have women are divided on the issue. I had a captain, Lauren Serrano, who's written in the Gazette. She's like, look, I don't want to be a guy.
Right.
Right. I joined the Marine Corps. Does the Marine Corps not want me now? And now I've had two kids. What am I going to do? Go out and get humiliated? Right. In front of everybody because I'm supposed to be able to do all these pull-ups. Well, I can't. I'm a woman. I don't want to be a man. So do you have any use for me anymore? And I asked that to the commandant, and I said, what do you say to women like this? And he said, we absolutely want you, and there absolutely is a well, it doesn't sound like it, though. It sounds like you want women to be guys now.
Yeah, we want – basically, we don't want to ever – this is speaking for the commandant here, speaking the way the philosophy seems to be going. We want to give whatever a woman is, whatever she wants.
Yeah. That's not easy
to do. We're afraid of the bet. Yes, it's ridiculous.
How do we do a standard for that? How do we do that so that you can? What does it mean to women? Is if you aren't more physically fit? And this is what she said. So now look, I'm an officer in the Marine Corps, right? With everything that entails, I now have this higher physical standard. I'm a mom, and I take care of my kids too, and like, how do you expect me to fucking do all this? And as a woman, if you don't get to the gym, it's not like you, she said, it's not like you guys. You guys can go to the gym and you could go knock out some pull-ups and go for a run and you could do first class PFT. We can't do that anymore. We got to get after it. I mean, and she said, and look, as you age as a woman, it's not like aging as a man because we're different. And I said, oh, shit. So and it was
the enemy she has is women who have a voice, you know, outside of the military, who are speaking up for the, you know, for the young women who can be in the Olympics,
right.
who want to be or right. think they want to be in combat arms.
Right. That's exactly
that's
it.
That's all they're
and she so, and her point was that is a small majority minority of the total women in the Marine Corps, but the rest of us are going down that road because they're being drugged by people outside the Marine Corps with an agenda.
Yeah. And think about that. Those rare women that can uphold that standard. Why would you waste a woman like that in 2-8 or first tanks?
And is she going that's back? Like a, is she going back at the age of 34 to be a company commander in 1-1 and take a battalion up on the shelf?
Yeah. Exactly. To me, it's a waste of an unusual asset, too.
And, I got to add something, guys. It's 2019.
Yes.
In 2020 at the Olympics, transgendered women will be able to compete as women, so I don't think you're going to see too many Olympic athletes who were born women.
Yeah. And that'll be...
You know what I mean?
The phrase, hoisted on their own petard, comes to mind. Because
yeah, have you seen like the MMA fighters that transition to being female? I mean, or wrestlers.
Yeah,
what not? It's gruesome to watch them fight. It's gruesome.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I just interjected my point. I just want to bring it back to reality because when we're talking women, we kind of got to define what we're talking about now. Otherwise, we're going to be racist, and I don't want that. You know, so are we talking were they born women? What chromosomes? Because it's confusing now, man.
Well,
I'm just trying to stay current with the times.
Well, I was reading an article about, I don't know if it was a wrestler in Texas. Well, it was a whole series of sports around, and they talked to, first of all, somebody who's got a son or daughter that's transgender, right? And the majority of this would have been, right, males, male transgenders who become females, right? And then they talked to the parents of a girl who was born a girl and who stayed a girl, and she's worked her whole life to be the Iowa 110 hurdles champion. And she gets smoked by a transgender athlete. And they're crushed. Like, wait a minute, what just happened? And how is that fair to our daughter? And then they kind of went through this. And then they tell it from the side of the transgender family. You know, and struggled their whole life and then found this and it's been wonderful in their life and blah, 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 blah. And so you see this collision of two people that feel they're injured and how do you make it right?
I don't know. Well, in the drive to destigmatize sexual deviance, they basically spared a whole half of the population of the country.
Deviance?
Yeah, fucking deviant.
Here we go.
If you can't decide whether you're a man or a woman, you got to screw loose. Sorry.
Well, I know.
No,
I know.
Gender dysphoria is a problem. But you know that
thank
reminds
you.
Me of
Dr. Lynch.
I know. It's a genuine psychological problem.
Thank you.
But I saw on Reason TV. Reason TV
followed
three high school guys. In Pennsylvania, one was a Chinese American, one was a Chinese with an American mom, so he's half and half. One was an African American, right? And all three of these guys are competing for valedictorian. All three of these kids are brilliant. I mean, they're so accomplished. It's amazing listening to them. They all apply to Ivy League schools. You can imagine the one person that gets in, right? And so they're talking to the parents. It's a fascinating thing to watch. They're talking to the parents. The African American guy, his parents are kind of defensive about it. They should be. He's defensive about it but he feels bad because they're all friends. And I would contend to you, based on post-traumatic winning, those two Chinese American kids are going to be better off because they're going to have to struggle harder, but they're going to get to where the max potential is. But the African American kid is always going to have to battle the perception that he got there because of his ethnicity, when in reality, he earned every bit of getting into an Ivy League school. Kid's a brilliant kid, but he's already defensive. And he's screwed over by a system that's perceived justifiably, particularly in the Ivy Leagues, as favoring his racial demographics and not favoring the racial demographics of his two best buddies. And that's doing him a disservice. that has nothing to do with transgenderism, but I wanted to rescue Jeff Will before he walked into a clip there because he was sounding kind of racist. Sorry, Jeff.
Racist? Well, being sexist.
No, that leads right to racism. Next thing you know, you're a climate denier.
All of that. But the problem is, how do you set up a system that's fair to that spectrum, whether you're talking about physical fitness in the Marine Corps, where you have the vast majority of women who join the Marine Corps, they don't want to be in combat arms. They want to have long careers, and they're devoted to what they do, but they don't want to be in the combat arms. Right. But you have the unicorns of the world, and the people that represent them are shoving this down their throat. And what are they going to do? Stand up in the public forum and say, "Hey, I think this is bullshit. These standards are bullshit. I don't want to do that." Nobody's going to, who's going to say that? They're going to say that on the down low. And then how do you create and now there's the discussion about, right, genderless standards in the Marine Corps. You know what that's code for? Lowering your standards.
Yeah.
Exactly.
I think different MOSs should have different jobs, should have different requirements.
Right.
Depending on what the job is. And in regards to what Timmy was saying, the answer to it is there's no part of your application that identifies your race, then you will get. Now, maybe you'll have all Asian guys and gals in college, but you'll get people if you go for the high standard who that's what they are. And if the field is academia, then that's appropriate. If the field is athletics, then your athletic ability is what's appropriate. However, To deny biology, that there's a difference between males and females, and then to say that these people who we've decided that it's not their brain that's wrong, that, you know, they're confused about what sex they are. Yeah. It's their physical, reality of them that's wrong, that needs to be fixed. Their minds are right. If we're going to say that that's a twisted way of looking at it, but that's how they look at it now, then what you're going to do, if you let that guy who thinks he's a woman change his body, you know, by the use of drugs and possibly surgery, to where now you can say this is a woman, yet he maintains a lot of those physical advantages, strength advantages and stuff that a male has,
yes,
he's going to smoke those natural girls,
yes,
or in whatever sport it is, and that's not fair.
And so,
it's not.
So we have to create a third class of humans and you can run in the transgender events?
No.
I
wouldn't waste my time in that. If the transgender community, if such a thing exists, wants to get together and do something like that,
it does.
Fine. It's a free country.
So what you're talking about is preserving the rights of women, right, from in particular in athletics, right, where transgender men changing gender to women would have a pronounced advantage.
Yes.
Yeah. No, hey, look, that's not a small issue when these things come up, because the girl is heartbroken, the family's heartbroken, and they're pissed. This isn't fair. It's not fair to my daughter.
Right.
So, yeah. And I got to agree with Jeff about the academic standards, because in the case I was talking to, all three of those kids would have gotten into the Ivy League. I mean, the African-American kid clearly deserved it. But there's going to, you know, we're trying to replace equality of opportunity with equality of outcome, and if you do that, there's no way you can do that without turning into some kind of a fascist or heavy-handed regime, because equality of outcome is not going to happen, because we're not all equal. You know, I'll never be in the NBA. It's never going to happen, or it never would have happened, and that's just the way it is. So what?
Let me tell you though, that is not the way the liberals in the world see the role of government. The role of government is to even things out, and so when you would only see more programs and more nuanced algorithms to bring everybody to a place of equality, and we would do what we would have. We would have a single standard. And if it, and again, and that's what's so, in my opinion, that's what's so disturbing about the outcomes of this stuff is, you know, you get told that, look, the standards are the standards, they'll never change. And then what do you have? You have at the Marine Corps Infantry Officer course, there's 9 hikes, 3 are evaluated. Since when the fuck did we do anything at that course that wasn't evaluated? And that you could fail it, let alone fail it more than one time, and you could graduate? Yeah. Fuck that. That's bullshit. Yet you had General Jason Bohm, who I taught as a second lieutenant, run out and say, that's the way it is now. Yeah. Like, are you fucking kidding me? And so...
Now, you can't have a quality of an outcome without putting your thumb on the scale, which invalidates the entire process.
Right.
Right. All right, well, I've had enough of this. I can't take anymore. All right, first of all, boys, thank you very much for coming on today. Always enjoy it.
Always a pleasure, bro.
All right. That is Tim Lynch, Jeff Kenny, both retired infantry officers, United States Marine Corps. Jeff, I'll see you later today.
Yep, I'm going to go back to work. I'm going to call the chief and make sure it's okay, and I'll see you up at Fiddler's Green. I'm going to be up there at 1400 with you.
All right. I'll see you then.
Okay.
There you have it. Jeff Kenny here. And, Timmy, thanks for the phone call. Appreciate it. Always fun.
Always fun. Wish I could come to Fiddler's Green with you, you lucky bastards. Have a great time.
Yeah, thanks. No, any day that I get to do this, I mean, it's always a good day because you see guys that we train. And honestly, the room's fairly black when it comes to resilience training and this discussion of destructive behavior. And then what's cool about post-traumatic winning is going there and turning the light on and say, look, there is a path. It runs through our history. It runs through the way we've been. Here's how you do it. Here are the things you need to do. And then they see it, and it's really cool. So it's always a fun day.
Well, good luck, brother, and have a great time.
All right, bud. Thanks. That is Tim Lynch here. We are done for the day. Yeah, that'll do it. That'll do it. All Marine Radio in the books for another day. How about that for a little bit of variety on a radio show? Yeah, relative to standards, right? They say they weren't going to drop them, but they're dropping them. All right, that'll do it. If you're just joining us, in the first hour, you're going to hear the news. You're going to hear some more live Iwo Jima audio. But coming up next, you're going to hear an interview that I did with Cal Humphrey, who was a PFC on Iwo Jima. And then after that, you'll hear the show repeat itself. So a little bit of bonus coverage. One of my favorite interviews. Absolutely fascinating about his life as he found his way into the Marine Corps. Wound up fighting on Island X, later to be known as Iwo Jima, and the way his life and his adventures unfolded in the Western Pacific in 1944 and 1945. And he's a wonderful man, and I thank my friend Jess Humphrey for setting all that up. So you'll hear him next. Have a great day, and we will see you tomorrow. And I think he's Lieutenant Colonel now. Scott Cuomo is going to join us. Scott's a writer and a thinker, former director of IOC, as a matter of fact, too. But he's going to join us. He's written a paper called Not Yet Openly at War, But Still Mostly at Peace, Exploiting the Opportunity to Become the 21st Century Force That Our Nation Needs. And written by Scott Cuomo, Captain Olivia Garrard, Major Jeff Cummings, and Lieutenant Colonel Noah Spatero. Why do I know Spatero's name? I'm not sure. So we'll talk about roles and missions tomorrow. So don't want to miss that. Como's a smart guy. I met him a few years ago when I was in the building at IOC, and he was a group chief. And we've been friends, and he's a good dude. So we'll see you tomorrow. I'll tell you how today's version of post-traumatic winning goes. But I'm excited to go back. You know, the Blue Diamond, right? I deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan with the headquarters element, with the 5th Marine Regiment and the 1st Marine Regiment, so storied regiments of the Marine Corps. I've served all my operational time in the Blue Diamond of the Marine Corps. So always an honor to get back there. So looking forward to it. Anyway, have a great day. On a Wednesday, All Marine Radio, over and out.